In Scotland, British police soon arrived at Paul Smith's home to convey the news of his death to his 28-year-old wife, Paula. Their elder son, Jordan, who was 4 years old, was suspicious of why the police had turned up, and so that night, Paula, devastated, decided to tell the boy the truth.
"Daddy is just like the Lion King," she explained. "He's gone to heaven now, and you won't see him again."
The reported death did accelerate ransom negotiations. ExxonMobil maintained a firm public line against payments, but its declared policy could not constrain either its contracting corporations or the governor of Akwa Ibom. Atta recalled that he was besieged by calls from the American, British, Romanian, Malaysian, and Indonesian embassies. They pressed him so hard to resolve the kidnapping that he found it difficult to actually carry out the negotiations. In the end, he conceded, he authorized a ransom payment. It is not clear what advice ExxonMobil offered about this decision, or whether it endorsed the payments or supplied funds. As to the kidnappers, Atta said,
"They were some misguided boys from my state, who had invited and escorted elements of a more experienced, hardcore kidnapping gang from another Delta state to attack the ExxonMobil compound."
State Department officials working with major American oil companies found by 2006 that they had diverged in our paths on the Delta kidnapping issue, the state official recalled. They would pay ransoms, and then we felt that was just actually contributing to the problem. Hostage negotiating teams led by state's Diplomatic Security Bureau did deploy to Nigeria, but then sat idle for lack of cooperation. The kidnappers packed their hostages back into speedboats and drove them to a rendezvous point with officers of the State Security Service, or SSS, the principal national Nigerian police and intelligence force. Assured of their payment, they freed their captives. ExxonMobil helicopters lifted the men to Lagos, where they at last boarded planes for home. Paul Smith telephoned his wife, Paula, to explain that he was not dead.
"He was completely calm," Paula recalled. "I was beside myself. All the family could hear me on the phone. Everyone was jumping around all over the place."
Once back in Scotland, Paul Smith issued a declaration.
"I won't be going back to Nigeria."
Influential scholarship documenting the resource curse emerged from the study of Venezuela's oil-induced woes, but Nigeria offered perhaps the most striking case study. Nigeria possessed a talented, well-educated elite, fertile land, and of course, oil revenue. The country's earnings from oil and gas sales from the early 1970s to 2008 totaled about $400 billion. Yet nearly half a century after independence, the country's population languished perpetually near the bottom of the United Nations' Human Development Index. Average Nigerian life expectancy remained only 46.5 years. 9/10 of the population lived on $2 a day or less. More than a third lacked sanitation and clean water, and the country's infant mortality rates remained among the world's highest. Such impoverished but less oil-burdened countries as Papua New Guinea and Zimbabwe ranked higher than Nigeria on the human development scale. Corruption, mismanagement, theft, and criminal violence were hallmarks of the government's performance. During the 1990s, the military dictator General Sani Abacha stole an estimated $4 billion of government funds, in addition to that taken by scores of cabinet officials, state governors, and their affiliated youth gangs. International oil and construction companies conspired in these crimes, or tolerated them, with see-no-evil policies. Halliburton and its subsidiary, Kellogg Brown & Root, agreed early in 2009 to pay $579 million in fines to settle charges related to their participation in a joint venture that systematically bribed Nigerian officials across a decade to secure more than $6 billion in construction contracts. Albert Jack Stanley, the chairman of KBR, named to his position by Halliburton chief executive Dick Cheney about 2 years before Cheney departed for the White House, pleaded guilty to criminal charges after personally authorizing a $23 million payment to a Gibraltar consultant to win Nigerian contracts. In Abuja, a tiny number of people have stolen a staggering amount of money, a Western diplomat there observed. The diplomat's work in liaison with Nigerian ministers routinely brought him into Abuja homes that you would be embarrassed to build in Beverly Hills, mansions decorated with ostentation that is just jaw-dropping. John Campbell, the American ambassador, referred to the capital's better neighborhoods as an example of Las Vegas Baroque. And this was what Nigeria's political overlords felt comfortable displaying in their home country, where fellow citizens could see it. They funneled much of the rest of their wealth abroad, into properties in London, New York, and Los Angeles. Poverty, disenfranchisement, and environmental degradation in the southern Niger Delta were acute. Ken Saro-Wiwa led a non-violent protest movement in the Delta to seek redress during the 1990s. Abacha arrested and executed him. Saro-Wiwa's idealism was exceptional in a resistance movement that increasingly migrated toward violence and crime. During elections in 2003, Delta political bosses armed youth gangs to compete for power. After the vote, the gangs moved into freelance rackets. They drew members, brand names, and cult practices from college campus fraternities, the Vikings, the Icelanders, the Outlaws, and their female counterparts, the Daughters of Jezebel, the Black Braziers, and the Vike Queens. They dealt drugs, siphoned oil from pipelines, or stole it in conspiracy with government officials or military officers, and they kidnapped Nigerians and foreigners for ransom. Unemployment ran high among the Niger Delta's young population. The criminal gangs were hiring, and if you could loll around the swamps, hold a gun, and occasionally take a few physical risks, you could have a paying job. As the gangs raised their political sights and economic ambition after 2006, their picaresque criminality, their matching headscarves, bandoliers, and speedboats, their bank robbery techniques, which included using massive charges of dynamite to blast away reinforced steel doors, seemed increasingly inspired by Hollywood.